Welcome back to another episode of the Chainsaw Enema Show. I'm Johnny B. Ghoul.
And I'm Mr. Mike.
This is our fifth installment of our Universal Monsters episodes.
Yes, it is.
And tonight we're talking about The Bride of Frankenstein from 1935.
Henry Frankenstein himself, thrown from the top of the burning mill by the very monster he had created.
Yeah.
Another outstanding horror classic directed by James Whale.
Yes, sir.
And for our top cast, we have Boris Karloff as the monster, Elsa Lanchester as the monster's mate, or in the credits of the movie, question mark, just like in the first Frankenstein. Only in this one, at the end of the credits, it was still a question mark, too.
I didn't notice that. That's kind of weird.
Yeah, there was some little hissy fit about it, I guess. Because she's top-billed cast, but she was unknown in the credits, so it's strange. And then we have Colin Clive back again as Henry Frankenstein, and Valerie Hobson as Elizabeth, who also played in the film Werewolf of London, released the same year as this. And she's also most known for the mother in the movie Willard from 1970. No, I'm sorry. That was Elsa Lanchester, who was in Willard from 1971, who stars Bruce Davidson.
Yeah, there's the...
The Willard, 71 and then the...
The one with Crispin Glover.
Yeah.
I didn't know that she was in Werewolf in London. Of course, I've never seen that movie, so...
Oh, that's one we gotta do then.
Yeah, I've never... That's surprisingly one I haven't seen.
It's a fantastic watch. I loved it. Yeah, when I owned the Universal Monsters Legacy Collections, that movie was on there with Lon Chaney Jr.'s Wolfman.
Oh, very cool.
And then this one, we've got, once again, I got to throw his name out there, Dwight Fry, who plays Carl. In a way, he's creepier in this than he was in the original Frankenstein. But I love his character.
Yeah, at least he made it through without getting his neck broke.
No, instead, he gets thrown off the building.
Well,
still... Killed by the monster.
I think I'd rather be thrown off a building than have my neck broke.
It depends on how high, because you could fall from a certain height and not die, and be paralyzed and
well,
worse than death.
If I fell off a building, I would hope I was high.
Yeah. Wait a minute. Oh, God damn it, Mike!
Yeah.
So let's start things off. This was my first time watching this movie from start to finish. And there were a few things that bothered me here and there, but overall, I have to say, I loved the movie. I, however, did not expect the ending to go down the way it did. By that, I mean it was super fast. Or as Mike likes to say, super-y super. I didn't expect that. It ended super fast. My girlfriend and I literally said, that can't be the end already. And then it ended the second after we said that.
And again, this is like a, you know, kind of a running trope that these Universal movies have. It's not anything, you know, long or drawn out. Nothing crazy. It's just, boom, it ends. As I've said before, I mean, I like a little bit of, you know, exposition. I like a little bit of, you know, story building and whatever.
There was a little bit of that in this.
But not, you know, I mean, comparative to nowadays.
It goes crazy. Two, three-hour movies. You know, you've got like six or seven different stories going on.
Right, so...
Sometimes it's good, some, you know, and it'll work. Sometimes it's awful.
You know, it's like we said about, you know, Terrifier 2. That movie ended about 719 times.
Oh, God, yeah, the ending there really got drawn out a bit. Still a fantastic movie.
Yeah, I loved the movie. It was fantastic.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ, I never thought it was going to end.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, these movies, I mean, I guess they were. It's kind of a known thing for its time, I think, for them to end this way. And I think it's one of those things that you have to come to expect when watching them.
Right,
and when I watched this, it just kind of went out of my head. I didn't expect it at all, and I wasn't thinking about it. I wonder how it's going to end, because I really, really wanted to see more of the bride.
Right.
She's literally on the screen for like only a minute or two.
It really goes to show you, though, how impactful that role was.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I'm like, wait a minute, only a couple minutes of screen time here, and she's the top billing cast, and everybody knows this character today.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you think of Frankenstein, you think of first, of course, you know, Frankenstein's monster.
Yeah.
And then you think of the Bride of Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the thing's been redone so many damn times, and parodies, and, you know, I mean, my God, you know, Looney Tunes cartoons did Bride of Frankenstein spoof, and...
Well, with that being said, Mike, before we dig in a little further, I wanted to ask you if you knew about the remake that's happening.
Yeah.
Maggie Gyllenhaal is directing a Netflix remake, and from what I read so far, it's going to star Christian Bale and Peter Sarsgaard, and it's supposed to start filming soon this year, from what I read.
Yeah, I heard about it.
I'm a little iffy whenever someone wants to do... I mean, this is going to be a direct remake, so it concerns me a little bit. I mean, Maggie Gyllenhaal only has only other one movie she's directed under her belt, so to jump straight into this, I don't know. It could be good. It might not be. I mean, we've reviewed a couple movies where it was their first time, and we were shocked.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a couple movies we just did recently. Well, a couple months back. Off the top of my head, I can't think of what. Oh, Tucker and Dale was one of them.
Yeah.
And then you have, what's his name, who did Trick or Treat? I forget his name.
Yeah, that guy with the face and the shirt.
The one guy there. Yeah. That one. I believe Trick or Treat was his first debut big movie, I think.
Yeah, I think he did some short films beforehand.
Yeah.
But I don't think that he did much of anything other than that.
And then you got the guy from Terrifier.
Yeah, Damien Leone.
Damien Leone, yeah. That was his first big movie, and then he did the second one, and look how great those movies turned out.
The third one's going to be here soon.
Hey, I can't wait for it. Yeah, I'm a little iffy about this. I've never been much of a fan of Maggie Gyllenhaal's, but that doesn't mean that it can't, you know, she can't do a good job. I mean, we don't, for all we know, she's a huge fan of these movies.
Right. See, here's my issue, and I'm not going to say it's going to be a bad movie, but it's her second time doing a film. This is a hugely iconic film, and it's a remake, and you know where I stand on most remakes.
We've
talked
here.
About this before.
Yep.
I've seen some amazing remakes, and then I've seen shit like the remake of Psycho. Or the remake of The Fog. I would rather light myself on fire than ever watch those movies again. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sure they have a fan base. Somebody out there might like them, but not me.
And how strange is it that we're reviewing this movie, and I just found out about this like the other day that they're doing a remake of The Bride of Frankenstein. I was like, wow, that's so strange. I'm seeing it everywhere now. Because they're getting close to filming it.
Yeah. Going off on another side note, apparently the first trailer for the Beetlejuice sequel just dropped.
But back to The Bride of Frankenstein. So yeah, like I said, it ended pretty quickly. But what about you, Mike? When did you last watch this? And what are some of your brief thoughts about it?
You're going to laugh.
I can't wait. Let's go.
Last time I watched this, other than last night, of course, was 98.
Did you notice anything different besides how incredible the restoration looked? Was there any changes?
Well, I think last time I watched it, you know, in 98, you know, I was still relatively young, and I was just so entranced in a lot of ways with the Universal movie monsters. Kind of now that I'm older and I'm looking at it through wiser eyes, I guess you could say. There's still some parts I really love about this movie. Of course, I love the way that Boris Karloff looked. I love the way that Elsa looked. I thought that was really cool. I completely forgot the screaming woman from freaking Invisible Man was in here.
Oh yeah, we'll get more into her, I think, when we do
we have
the plot.
To?
Yeah, we will. Some fun trivia here. You know, Colin Clive was in this. They didn't want to cast him, but James Whale wanted to. He just found him hysterical. He had this hysterical quality, just like he was in the first Frankenstein, and he felt that he was necessary for the film. 2 years he died after this film. He was 37. I still find it amazing, because after watching this movie and seeing how great Colin Clive still was as an actor throughout the movie, every time I saw him, I just could not believe, like, wow, 2 years after this movie, he passed away.
Yep.
It's just a shame.
Yep.
And you know, I found it kind of interesting, too. Another piece of trivia, Elsa was not fond of working with Jack Pierce. Did you watch the special features?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, they mentioned this on here. And I guess when going in for makeup, you had to wait for Jack to say hello, because he was very much in control of everything.
Right.
You couldn't just go in and say hi. It was just it sounded like a very tense atmosphere whenever you would go in, or at least from what Elsa said. And from other unknown sources, I guess it's rumored that Jack Pierce was a grumpy old man. I've heard different things, because I've always heard Jack Pierce was great to work with. He did a fantastic job. But then again, you have people that have their unique way of doing things, and it makes them a little eccentric. And I think maybe that's why he was the way he was. You know, when you entered into his realm. That was, you know, it was his space.
Yeah.
He was in control and he knew what he was doing. So maybe she just got the wrong impression of him, but I don't know, because I've heard many, I've heard Elsa, she doesn't seem like the greatest person from a lot of the stories that I've read.
Yeah, same here.
She's fantastic in this movie, don't get me wrong. And I thought she was gorgeous as ever as the bride. You know, I mean, outside of the pictures and her personal life, that's a whole nother story. I don't want to get into it. Yeah, it's not to say that she wasn't a great actress. Well, she was.
I really think it was more along the lines of who you were.
Mm-hmm.
Because whereas you got on one side, you've got all these people saying, you know, especially Boris Karloff, that Jack was a great guy, you know, always professional, always whatever. When you're in that position, it doesn't matter who you are, what you do, whatever. You're always going to have one, you know, some people saying you're great and other people saying that you were a pain to work with.
Yeah, there's always two sides.
Yeah, I mean,
maybe she caught him on a bad day, too.
It could be. I mean, you know, even Tom Savini, who I've heard is one of the nicest guys on the planet, there's some people out there that say that he was terrible to work with.
Like I said before, maybe he was caught on a bad day.
Could very well be.
Everybody has their bad days, but that doesn't make them who they are because of that bad day. But when you're a celebrity and you're out there in the
you're constantly
the light,
scrutinized.
You're constantly. So Boris Karloff in this movie... And I completely understand it. He protested against the decision to make the monster speak, but was overruled by the studio. The studio wanted it. Since he was required to speak in the film, Karloff, he wasn't able to move. He couldn't remove his partial bridge work because he needed it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a little upset about that because that was a big deal in the first one. Because you can compare the two. Looking at him in the first film, in my opinion, I think he looked a bazillion times creepier. And he just looked so much better in the first one than he did in this one. I mean, they pretty much did the same thing, but there were a couple things that they had to do differently. Like the burns on his... he's got like one burn on his cheek, a little singed up on his hair. They started doing the rubber prosthetic, I think, in this part, and it's very noticeable. Everything's pretty much the same, but I'm telling you, Jack Pierce, I mean, he worked on this too. He did, and it was good, but it wasn't like the original.
No.
And he had that, sunken cheek appearance in the first film. And that's why the monster in this one, you see his face, it's a little bit more full. Also, director James Whale originally did not want to do a sequel to Frankenstein. He fought it for a while. For a time, Universal considered producing the sequel without Whale's involvement, which I cannot...
I can't imagine.
I mean, they did other Frankensteins after this.
Right.
I mean, there's so many of them.
Right.
And you can tell that they don't have that unique quality that these movies did with James Whale. He just had that eye for the macabre in these sort of films.
Well, from what I understand, James Whale never wanted to do sequels to any of his movies. He was very much so against it, and the sequels that he did do were very begrudgingly done. Mm-hmm. And I can understand that to an extent. You know, I kind of see when you do one movie, you know, if that movie came out at, you know, the way you wanted, as good as you wanted it to be, and then the studio's like, okay, we're going to do another one. And you're always thinking in the back of your head, well, what if this one tarnishes the legacy of the first one?
Not long before filming again, Colin Clive, he actually broke his leg in a horse riding accident. Consequently, most of Frankenstein scenes were shot with him sitting. And you can see that in this film. I did notice that after I read this. Jack Pierce altered the makeup. It had to reflect that he survived the mill fire after the first one. With, you know, like he's got the flesh burns and much of his hair singed off, like I was saying. So I didn't mention that before. That's one of the reasons why they went this direction. And he does look good. I mean, I do like the way it looks. I just prefer his appearance in the first film.
Yeah, I do too. Like I said, I mean, there's some things about this movie that I really, really, really loved, but there's also some there's some things that I forgot about that just kind of brings down the overall quality.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll get into that.
When filming the scene where the monster, Boris Karloff emerges from the burnt windmill, Boris Karloff actually slipped and fell into the water-filled well, and this was sometime, I think, early on in the film.
Right.
And because in the beginning, you have the guy going looking for the monster, wanting to see with his own eyes that he's dead, because he's the one from, it's a different actor, but the same character from the first one.
Right.
Where Frankenstein's monster threw his daughter in the water, and she ended up drowning. So they go looking for him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he ends up falling in, and then you see Frankenstein emerge from there. But at some point, Boris Karloff fell, and it was discovered that he dislocated his hip from the fall.
Oh,
and,
wonderful.
The hip was strapped into place, and Karloff pretty much soldiered on through the movie, which doesn't surprise me. That's awesome. And he continued to receive massage and heat treatments for the rest of shooting the film.
Mm-hmm.
They treated him a little bit more like a star in this one, especially after The Mummy.
Right.
And
right.
The other previous movies and Frankenstein. He was way more of a star at this point.
I can tell you from personal experience, I didn't dislocate my entire hip, but I dislocate what's called the hip flexor. Hey, boy.
Feels good, huh?
Oh, no. I said many foul words.
And Elsa Lanchester, when she was in bandages,
mm-hmm.
she spent days like trussed up in tight bandages. They were really tight, I guess. And she right. needed to be fed by her dresser since she could not use her fingers. They were wrapped. And according to one story, one of her stand-ins had a screaming attack of claustrophobia.
Oh, God.
And I can just imagine, because I'm claustrophobic. So and as I was watching the film and I saw that she was in these bandages,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'd be able to do it either. I mean, it doesn't seem like a big deal. But when you're actually in it, she's in these tight bandages, you can't get out. She pretty right. much looks like a mummy in this. Yeah, that had to be pretty scary. I can't believe that. I guess she had no issues doing it. There was no, I didn't hear anything about it. I just heard that her stand-in had some screaming attack and had a hard time doing it. And according to Elsa Lanchester, her bride makeup took 3 hours on the face alone. And Boris Karloff's took 5 in this. So a little longer than the first one. I think in the first one it was about 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
This one I think took a little bit longer because I had to do a couple things different. I think with the burns.
Right.
And applying the prosthetic on the head.
Well, after doing The Mummy, I'm sure that was a cakewalk.
That's exactly what I was thinking about. As I was watching this, I was like, well, he got through The Mummy. He can get through this no problem.
Yeah.
It wasn't as uncomfortable. And they made him more comfortable in this one, too, they said, because in the first one, he really tore his body up with the heavy, what was it, 20-pound boots he had to wear?
15,
or 25.
20, some crazy.
And then those shoulder pads.
Like
and, he sweated off 20 pounds laboring in this costume, though. It was extremely hot, I guess, in this one, too. So it goes back to what you said before. Like, why the hell couldn't they pick a better time to film? But that's just how it is in filming, I guess. You know, you're there when the producer and director and everyone wants you there.
Right.
So, you know, Elsa Lanchester was only 5'4".
Really?
Yep. For this role, she was placed on stilts. And that made her 7 feet
tall. I would imagine.
Yeah, because they wanted her to, I'm assuming they wanted her to match Boris Karloff's height.
Well, she was about 12 feet with that freaking hairdo.
Of the chick who plays Valerie Hobson, who's Henry's fiance,
mm-hmm.
or wife. No, they're now married,
because
at the end of the first movie, that's right, he was already married. She was only 17 years old when she did this film.
Oh, wow.
And Colin Clive was 35. That is one hell of an age gap there.
Just a little bit.
Yeah. And I found this out before we watched the movie last night. So as soon as I saw her on the screen, I'm looking at her and thinking, she doesn't look 17.
Right.
She really doesn't. She could pass for like a 30, like seriously a 30-year-old. I'm looking at her and I'm like, wow, she's only 17. They must have really done her makeup.
I remember that song.
I hate you so fucking much, Mike. God damn it.
Oh, I'm retarded.
Now, did you know Bela Lugosi was considered for the role of Dr. Pretorius?
Yes, I did, actually.
That would have been fucking awesome. And also, Claude Rains was actually offered the role of Dr. Pretorius, but he couldn't do it. He was unavailable because he was filming The Mystery of Edwin Drood. I've never seen that movie, but it was from 1935.
That's a new one on me.
Yeah. I don't know if it's a horror movie. It sounds like it would be more of like a mystery drama type of movie. Wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, Bella or Claude would have been really cool to see in that part.
That definitely would have been interesting, that's for sure.
Yeah, I love sitting and kind of thinking, you know, what if on some of these parts.
Yeah, in the last episode you mentioned that because you couldn't think of anyone else that would make a perfect Invisible Man character other than Claude Rains and Vincent Price.
Right.
And it's true. I can't either. Perfect. For this time.
Oh, yes. Yeah. You know, there's just iconic roles that I can't think of anybody else playing, even though they did the earlier version of Red Dragon, you know, Manhunter, and they had the other guy whose name I can't remember playing Hannibal. Hannibal, in my mind, will always be Anthony Hopkins. He just played that so perfectly.
He was just a fantastic nut job serial killer.
He was creepy as shit is what he was.
He's just a fantastic actor all around, too. He's
sitting there listening to classical music, beating the piss out of somebody with a nightstick.
You want to get into the movie plot and then we can chat more about it?
Oh, I suppose.
It's going to be fun. It starts out on a stormy night. Percy Shelley and Lord Byron praise Mary Shelley, and Mary Shelley is actually played by Elsa Lanchester in this, too.
Yeah.
We were a little bit confused on what was happening here, and like we had to look it up because I was like, wait a minute, is she, what's happening here? When did she die? No, she's telling the story.
Yeah.
And I had to think about it. I'm like, wait, she's Mary Shelley, so that, yeah. I thought that was cool, though. It was cool.
Yeah.
She did a good job. So she praising her for the story of Frankenstein and his monster, and reminding them that her intention was to impart a moral lesson. Mary says that she's got one more story to tell, and the scene shifts to the end of 1931 Frankenstein.
I love that segue.
And I loved this part. You loved what?
The segue between...
Oh, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Her saying that she had one last story, and then it going directly into it.
Yeah, that was
really
awesome.
I thought
that
was really well done.
Really awesome. So it starts out with the villagers gathering around the burned windmill, cheering because of the death of the monster.
Right.
And that's exactly where it ended in the first one. They were standing there cheering, and then it went to Henry Frankenstein, and what's his name there? Burgermeister Fuck. Funny guy.
Burgermeister Fuck?
Yeah, that's his name.
You talking about his father or the Burgermeister?
His father, yes, his father.
Baron Frankenstein. Burgermeister Fuck?
I don't know.
Wow.
I lost my head there for a second. Anyway, their joy is tempered by the realization that Henry Frankenstein is also apparently dead. And I mean, that would make sense. He's responsible for the monster, so they were pretty pissed off with him as well. So Hans, the father of the girl creature who drowned in the previous film, we just spoke of this. He, like you said, wants to see the monster's bones. He wants to see that he's dead and burned up. He falls into the flooded pit underneath the mill, and it's awesome. And you see where the monster has survived the fire. And I absolutely love this scene because you see the monster's hand, and then you see him kind of like come out of like a space, like in a little space underneath the ground or whatever.
Right.
Like a little hollow part, like little cave part he comes out of. It's just such a remarkable scene because that's where you're first introduced to him in this film.
Right.
So he comes out and he ends up strangling the guy.
I would too. I'd be probably pissed.
So, hauling himself from the pit, the monster casts Hans' wife into the pit to her death as well. And what a funny part, because she wasn't even looking at who she was pulling up. She thought it was her husband, and it turned out to be Frankenstein. How could you not know the difference? He had to have weighed like twice as much.
You're doing it again.
I know, I'm analyzing it. I apologize. You can't analyze these movies that much. But anyway, she pulls him up, turns around, screams, and he just launches her in, no problem.
Yeah.
The next encounters Minnie, who is played by Mike's favorite, Una O'Connor.
Yeah.
And she flees in terror. Now, I have to say, I've been waiting for this.
Ugh.
She surprisingly was not as annoying in this as she was in The Invisible Man.
Subjective.
Well, when she screams, when she sees the monster and she screams, that actually looked like it could be kind of funny, because the fact that she makes, like the face that she makes as she's screaming, is an obvious goofy and frightened facial expression compared to her annoying, obnoxious scream in The Invisible Man, where she just screams and screams. In this one, she made a goofy ass face. And yeah, it's subjective. You either like it or you don't, but at least you can see that it's clear that she was trying to be funny and they wanted her to be funny in this part.
Still made my teeth want to fall out.
I think that The Invisible Man is responsible for it, because if you didn't see her in The Invisible Man, you might stomach this a little better.
I highly doubt it.
So, Henry's body returns to his fiancée after this. And his fiancée, once again, played by Valerie Hobson. So they're at the castle home, and Minnie arrives to sound the alarm about the monster, but her warning goes unheeded. No one believes her because she's apparently a nut. She has way more lines in this than she did in The Invisible Man, too.
Mm-hmm.
She was in it quite a bit, like throughout the whole movie, I think.
I thought she did a pretty damn good job.
Yeah, I mean, she was, like I said, she wasn't as annoying. I really expect, as soon as I saw her on the screen when we started this movie, I, same as you, I thought, oh my God,
yeah.
No.
I pick, but I think all in all, she did a pretty good job for the role she had.
So Elizabeth, seeing Henry move, realizes that he's still alive. They thought he was dead when they brought him back to the castle home. So he's nursed back to health by Elizabeth, and Henry has renounced his creation, but still believes he might be destined to unlock the secret life and immortality. A hysterical Elizabeth cries. I found this scene very strange because I didn't know what was happening. We thought the monster was across the room when she was screaming, oh look, like she's really like overdoing it here.
Right, she's hamming it up.
Little hokey. A hysterical Elizabeth cries because she says she sees death coming, foreshadowing the arrival of Henry's former mentor. And this is where you meet the infamous Dr. Pretorius. And when I first saw this guy on the screen, I didn't care for him at first, but as he starts to discuss whatever it is he discusses here, I forget, plans and everything and how to create him, this is where he wants to create a mate for his monster,
right,
and offers a toast to their venture, a new world of gods and monsters, he says. But he before this, like when he first shows up and he knocks on the door, I didn't care for him. I'm like, who is this guy? He's kind of annoying. As time goes on and you watch him, he did a fantastic
job.
Yes,
he did.
I was really surprised. I even said this to my girlfriend as we're watching it. I said he was annoying at first, but I could see why they got him for the role.
Yeah, he definitely fit that role perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of felt the same way when I first saw it. I was like, this guy is not good at all.
Kind of overdid it a little bit in the beginning there.
But I think that's kind of why they did it.
To show that he's a prick.
Yeah.
Because he's really the evil one.
Oh, yeah. He's definitely the bad guy in this whole situation.
Mm-hmm. He did a great job.
Oh, he did fantastic. And I can't remember his damn name.
Yeah, it's not an... Oh, Ernest Thesiger.
Yeah.
Did I say that right?
Close enough.
So yeah, Dr. Pretorius shows Henry several things that he's created, including a miniature queen, king, devil, looked like a Dracula, and a mermaid, and these little... And I gotta point out here that the cinematography, holy shit, that they up they like their game.
Oh yeah.
You really can see what amazing work was done, especially at this part, because it beats some of the stuff today.
Just think about this for a second. Frankenstein came out in what, 31?
Yes.
This came out in 35?
Yep.
That's 4 years difference.
Yeah.
And look how much the cinematography had, you know,
it
matured.
It really upped its game at that point.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Even between the beginning of the, you know, genre of the Universal movie monster.
Mm-hmm.
To 35, how much it had grown. Not to say there's not some special effects in here that are goofy as shit. Again, the bats, oh my God.
The monster saves this young shepherdness from drowning. So, and I thought this was cool because I'm like, oh, the opposite from the first one. And
so he learned from his mistake.
Yeah, he did. Then I wanted to point out, he learned very quickly because he's speaking in this.
Mm-hmm.
He's running around. He can walk fine. He's not, you know, I mean, he's still doing the, you know, here and there, but he talks and he's quick on his feet in this one compared to the last one.
Maybe when he fell in the mill, it knocked some sense into him.
He could have maybe rattled his abnormal brain. I don't know. This next scene, it shows him wandering around this forest, and it's a beautiful forest. As I'm watching it, I looked over at my girlfriend and I said, all right, we're gonna see some foxes, Bambi's gonna come out, some birds chirping, you know. Now you see the monster just kind of roaming around. It was a really cool shot.
You gotta kind of wonder how much this was done on a set and how much of it was done in actual, you know, nature. Because I don't think that was a set. That was like...
No, this was a set.
Was it really?
It was all created. Yeah, it was James Whale's idea.
Holy crap.
They mentioned it in the special features that one of the film historians interviewed Elsa Lanchester. Lester before she died. Like, I think 10 years before she passed away. Because she passed away in the late 80s, I believe. Mm-hmm. 88, I think.
Right.
Don't quote me on that, but I believe it was the 80s. And one of the film historians interviewed her and asked about James Whale's vision and what he came up with. He didn't build the set or anything like that, he said. He didn't do that. But yes, it was his idea. He jotted some notes and sketches, and that was one of them that they designed and built, I guess.
Damn, and they did a damn good job.
Yeah, I thought the same thing, too. Because in some scenes in these movies, you can tell, like, wow, that's totally a set. You can see the shadow here. You can see the wrinkle of the curtain here.
And you know,
but in this one, very impressive.
That was actually, if you remember correctly, we were talking about on the first Frankenstein. It's one of the downsides of the restoration is there are times you can tell it's a set.
Yeah.
Like, really, really tell it's a set.
Because they make it so much more crisp and clear on these restorations.
Yeah.
That for this time, what it was filmed on, like how everything looked on these films when they came out, they were
right.
not as crisp and clear as they are today. So, yeah, you notice a hell of a lot more that you couldn't on these other films because of when you look at it back then, you couldn't see certain mistakes, I guess you could say.
Right. That forest scene, damn, I'm really surprised at that.
And I love the scene, too. I laughed hysterically. At this part coming up, he saves a young shepherdess from drowning, and she's screaming like crazy because he's this, you know, hideous monster, and he's trying to shut her up and, you know, grunting and groaning, and she's screaming, and her screams alert these two hunters that just happen to be walking through and shoots and injures him. They shoot him in his arm.
Right.
And before they shoot him in the arm, he holds his hands out, kind of reminded me of the first one. Like, he didn't know what to do or how to react or how to basically signal, like, no, don't shoot me.
Right.
He just kind of held his hands up like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. And then they shot him in the arm and he got mad and ran away. All pissed off. I would too. But did you see the sheep scream or bat in this part as all this was happening?
Yes,
it,
I did.
Like, close up on the sheep. I don't know why, but I was dying laughing at this scene. I don't know if it was just because I was tired or maybe because it was just so randomly thrown in, but I look over and my girlfriend's kind of smiling and kind of looking at me like, what's so funny? It's not that funny. And it was funny to me. It was a close up and they really scream. It's like close up of Frankenstein, close up of the girl, and then boom, there's a sheep. It all happened so fast and it was so funny.
I didn't laugh, but I was sitting there like, wait, what? Why? Why the hell? It made no freaking sense. I mean, it's James's vision.
I think it was just the show that there's just all this chaos going on and it scared the animals as well. I don't know. Or maybe the sheep thought that they were going to get shot next. I don't know. It was fun.
It was different.
The hunters, they raise a mob that sets out in pursuit and captured. They throw him up on this pole and is hauled to the dungeon and is chained in there. They pointed this out quite a few times on the special features about how, because there was a lot of like religious stuff that was thrown in here and it was borderline blasphemy.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to be really careful before they presented it to the studio upon the release.
Right.
Because back in this day, you had to be extremely careful or it would be shut down because so many people would be offended and outraged by some of the stuff they threw in here. Watching it today, though, it's like, okay, yeah, I could see it, but it's not that bad. Like when they string him up to the pole, almost like he's on a crucifix in Jesus pose. I thought it was a really cool scene.
Before the Motion Picture Association of America, there was, I believe it was called the Bureau of Morality. They were ungodly strict about what you could and could not get away with. Not just with religious tones in your movie, but sex, violence, you know, all that. That shit.
All that jazz.
You know, and I mean, the MPAA is bad. These people were a million times worse because anything that they found quote unquote offensive, that was it. There was no go. And if I remember correctly, this was a government run program. I'm not 100% sure.
I wouldn't be surprised.
But I mean, it was insane. And then I believe later on when the communist scare happened, that's when they started gaining a lot of power. But anyways, I don't know.
You were ranting again.
I do that a lot. You should know that by now.
So now they're in this dungeon where they chained up the monster super fast, too. I remember, like, wow, he's already there and chained. They really don't fuck around. They just cut right to it. And this is a very famous scene here because the monster's sitting there chained up and he's got like these sides coming out around his neck or something to where he can't like move much.
Right.
They don't realize how unbelievably strong he is because he rips the chains. It's a really cool scene.
I want, I know it's another random thing.
Another rant.
I'm sorry. but I've always wondered if the part out of Goonies with Sloth, when he's ripping the chains out of the wall to grab the baby Ruth.
Yeah.
I wonder if they got inspiration from that.
It wouldn't surprise me. I could see how there could be a little inspiration. They leave the monster alone, and yeah, he breaks the chains and escapes. And I have to say, this is a wicked cool part. He breaks the chains. Police are right outside the door, and one of them yells, "He's escaped!" And I'm like, he's still locked in a room.
You're doing it again.
I know, but I have to throw this out. He shoots him, and I'm like, they didn't have to shoot him. He's not. And as soon as I said he's not, he rips off the door. Okay, now you can shoot him. But yeah, I know, I'm doing it again. So that night, the monster encounters a gypsy family, and he ends up burning his hand by their campfire. Following the sound by a violin player, the monster encounters an old blind hermit who thanks God for sending him a friend.
I was going to make
now,
an espresso.
I was just going to say, go ahead and say it, Gene Hackman. I was thinking about it this entire time. And even in the Young Frankenstein spoof that they did, there's still heart to it and emotion. Even in that one. It's hilarious.
Best part, one of the best parts of the movie. I won't say it's the best.
It's up there.
Yeah.
But this part, I was really looking forward to seeing because I've never seen the original. I mean, in Young Frankenstein, I watch it. It's just hell. Even if you haven't seen this scene in Bride of Frankenstein, it's still pretty fucking hilarious in Young Frankenstein. But now that I've seen Bride of Frankenstein, the next time I watch Young Frankenstein, I'm probably going to enjoy it even more because I'm going to notice all these subtle things that they did in the original. This guy teaches the monster words like friend and good and shares a meal with him. And they're having a great time. I mean, everything's going so well and you kind of just, it didn't feel like a horror movie anymore. It's just like, oh, you know, Frankenstein's having fun. He plays the violin for him. He's shaking his head, smiling, eating bread. And it's just a good part. It's an incredible scene. It really is.
And
then the two fucking hunters come in and they ruin everything.
Asshole.
The two lost hunters, they stumble into the cottage and they recognize the monster and they kind of freak out. They say to the hermit, you know, this is the monster who's been terrorizing the whole town. What's wrong with you, man? And then they realize he's blind. So they get him out of there. And the blind guy is just like, why are you doing this? There's nothing wrong with it. We're just hanging out, basically, is what he said. Frankenstein's monster attacks them and accidentally burns down the cottage. I remember thinking, oh, now you did it.
Yeah.
Now you fucking did it. Poor, but the guy's blind. Now he has no place to live. Way to go. But it wasn't his fault. The two hunters, they came in and ruined everything. So he ended up attacking them and it burned down the cottage. And the hunters led the hermit away, taking refuge from another angry mob in an underground crypt. The monster spies Pretorius and his cronies, Carl, who's played by Dwight Fry, and this guy Ludwig, breaking open a grave in this crypt. Very, very awesome setting, I thought.
Yeah.
I think that was part of the studio, but it looked really fucking cool. I'd hang out there too. And Dr. Pretorius is hanging out there eating and drinking wine.
And I remember thinking Halloween he's just decorations.
Well, he's got like the skull, I think, on the platter where he's like eating and drinking wine and he's smoking a cigar. But,
as one tends to do.
Yeah, in the henchmen, they're gone. Dr. Pretorius stays and enjoys a light supper. And he mentions that, you know, I like it here. I feel right at home here. And I guess it makes sense because he works with, you know, cadavers and, you know. He's
must have been
cemeteries.
A goth kid.
He probably did that exist around? It did, but in a different way.
Yeah.
The whole goth thing was very different back then.
Oh, yeah.
It didn't mean then what it means today, that's
no,
for sure.
No, it did not. I'm sure they didn't sit around listening to The Cure.
Hey!
I love the Cure. Relax, I love The Cure, I'm just saying.
Okay, so at this part, while he's eating, the monster approaches Dr. Pretorius, and he learns that his plans are to create a mate for him. Well, before he tells him his plans, he gives him a smoke, right? Does he give him a cigar? I think he does.
Yeah.
And then he drinks some wine with him.
Mm-hmm.
It's hilarious. Frankenstein loves wine. He's like drunk through most of this. He doesn't even know it because he's a monster, but Frankenstein's getting buzzed.
That's all you need is a, you know, 12-foot tall lush.
That's good for the town. So Henry and Elizabeth, they're visited by Dr. Pretorius once again, and he's ready for Henry to do his part like they agreed on in the beginning.
Right.
Their grand collaboration, which Henry didn't want to do in the first place, but then he decided to, and then Henry refuses at this point, and Pretorius ends up calling the monster in, who demands Henry's help, and Henry's like, I remember watching this, I was like, oh boy, it's going down now, here we go, and yeah, Henry is just like, get him out of here. So Henry again refuses Dr. Pretorius's orders, and Dr. Pretorius orders the monsters out because Henry said he's not going to talk with that thing anywhere around. Oh. I guess he's too scared. He seems right. Scared and frightened.
Well, hell, I would be too.
Oh, yeah. He knows what he did was wrong, and you know Henry Frankenstein feels sorry for it, and he just wants it to be over. So you feel for the guy. And I gotta say, for an alcoholic that has worsened since the first one in 1931... I thought he was really on point.
Oh, yeah.
Most of his line. I mean, in certain parts, maybe you can tell. He seems like he's a little... had a few drinks here, maybe. Right. You can kind of tell. But maybe he wasn't drinking at all on the set. I don't know.
From what I've seen of his work, alcohol or not, he was an amazing actor.
Yeah, it didn't really show on film. It really didn't. It's amazing how... Well, I mean, there's a lot of alcoholics that can just go about doing whatever.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
and you'd never know it. So secretly signaling him, Dr. Pretorius, he secretly signals to the monster to kidnap Elizabeth, who's right in the next room. And Pretorius guarantees her safe return upon Henry's participation. Obviously, now Henry has no choice but to participate in this charade.
He technically has a choice, but it's not a very good one.
No, it's not a... He wants his woman back. I can understand that. I'd probably do the same thing. So Henry returns to his tower laboratory, where, in spite of himself, he grows excited over his work, which makes sense because he does... You know he loves his work. For him to get to this point in his career,
yeah,
I guess you can call it, or with his work, you knew he was excited about it.
Well, sure.
But he knew he created something terrible and menacing and didn't want anything to do with it anymore. So it's kind of like one of those, like, I love my work, but...
I hate what I created.
Yeah, exactly. So while they're doing their work, he's growing with excitement a little bit. After being assured of Elizabeth's safety, Henry completes the bride's body at this point. But first, I want to talk about how they got the bride, because it's not in my notes here. They send Carl, Dwight Fry, out to get... They needed a heart, because the one that they had wasn't beating properly. They had this, like, little machine, which I thought was very cool. I'm looking at it, and I'm like, man, for 1935, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
So they go out to get a heart, and I guess Dwight Fry was supposed to get... Well, I don't think Henry knew it was going to be a fresh heart. They sent old Dwight... Well, old Carl out there, and ended up grabbing and bagging this lady walking down a dark alley, and I guess...
She had an abnormal
heart. Well, no, actually, her heart was fine, because after they brought it back, it was beating to the normal rate that they want. They can't get my words out of here. The heart was beating at a normal rate, which they wanted. And Henry freaks out once he finds out it was a live one. But Dr. Pretorius, being the madman that he is, lied and said that it was a criminal case or something?
Yeah.
And this is like the highlight of the movie, in my opinion. This is like the best part. And this is when I was really, really intrigued by this scene. Because this is where you're going to see kind of like what you saw in the original Frankenstein. The lightning, the storm rolls in.
Yep.
And they're going to bring the bride to life. So the storm rages in and they make final preparations and are made to bring the bride to life at this point. Her bandage-wrapped body's raised through the roof and lightning strikes a kite. They send these kites out and sending electricity through to the bride. So Henry and Dr. Pretorius lower her back down and they realize that... And it's cool because at this part, Henry says, she's alive! It's very cool. I loved it because in the first one, it's alive and now she's alive. It was just... I was waiting for it.
Yeah, it was a nice throwback.
She's alive! Alive!
So they remove her bandages and they help her to stand. The Bride of Frankenstein.
The Bride of Frankenstein.
Dr. Pretorius declares, and she's standing there dressed in this long white, like, dress robe type thing, and she's got her long hair, like, sticking out, and it's just, it's a sight.
The stitching around the face.
The stitching around the face is very, very cool. And Jack Pierce enjoyed doing the stitching, I guess. And I guess it took him a long time. It took him the longest time. There's one stitch that's under her jawline
mm-hmm.
that goes straight back to her like neck or to her behind her earlobe, I think.
Right.
Because she's got two of them. And I guess it took him the longest to do that stitching. They found it funny because you barely see it in the movie. But Jack Pierce loved his work. Even if it's just for a split second, you know. I mean, it could have a great impact.
Oh, well, I mean,
I was noticing it.
Yeah, for me, I mean, when the first time I saw this movie, that was the first thing I noticed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like that is really cool looking.
It was really impressive work. It was done really well, and the restoration made it look even better too. Like just phenomenal.
Oh yeah, no. It's Jack Pierce. I can't think of anything he did that wasn't amazing looking.
So the excited monster sees his mate, the bride, and reaches out to her, and he says, "Friend." And as he moves closer, the bride screams and rejects him. The monster says,
"She hates me like others,"
in a very like low monstrous type of sad voice, I guess.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth races to Henry's side at this point, and the monster rampages through the laboratory because he's pretty pissed off that the bride that was supposed to be for him doesn't want anything to do with him. And I gotta point out here, she kind of reminds me of like a cockatiel or something, because her jerky like head movements where she's like looking up, down, left, right, like, all over the place. It's like, what the hell's wrong with you? I loved it, though. It worked great for the film. It really was, like, it was riveting to watch. It really was. But I just couldn't help think of, like, a bird. You know how, like, birds will, like, move their heads so, like, jerky?
You know, I've seen many interviews about this movie, and I have never, not one time, heard anybody compare the bride to a fucking cockatiel.
I think is it a cockatiel? I think.
Yeah.
One of those birds. I said it to my girlfriend too. She laughed and she said, yeah, I could see it. I could see it.
Moving right along.
So the monster rampages through the laboratory at this point, and the monster tells Henry and Elizabeth, because they're running out the door, and Henry and Elizabeth look back at him and sees the monster, and the monster says, "Yes, go, you live." And I'm like, wait, what? Really? Seriously? Okay, cool.
Well,
you know,
yeah,
I guess he was more pissed off at Dr. Pretorius. He was going to make things better for him, and he didn't.
And I kind of feel like maybe he realized that they were supposed to be there and he wasn't.
But it also brings you back to the first movie. He wanted him dead because he created him.
Right.
He knows he's the creator. But again, analyzing this too much, he's a monster. I don't know. He's called the monster.
Right.
At this point of the movie, I was more referring to him as just a being that was made, that was right. Man-made.
Yeah,
that's really what he is. Yeah,
he didn't ask for any of this.
No, he didn't. You know? He didn't do anything, and you can sympathize with him through this whole film too.
Oh yeah,
everything that he's doing, I'm like sympathizing with him, and I'm just thinking, this poor man-made monster.
Well, I kind of understand it in a way, considering, you know, the fact that I was a victim of being bullied, so I understand that feeling.
Yeah.
I really relate to the monster in these movies in a lot of ways.
Oh, especially when he says, and this was earlier on, oh, this was when he first meets Dr. Pretorius, I think.
Mm.
He looks at him. Dr. Pretorius asks him, "Do you know what you are, or who made you and what you are," or something? And he says, "Yes." Or what does he say? He says something, and then he says,
"Topo Gijo."
He says,
"Love, dead, hate, living."
And a great Misfits song, "Hate the Living, Love the Dead," by the way.
This is
the first thing I thought of. I was like, that's awesome. But I love it when he says that, because I'm like, yeah, that's how I feel every day.
I love dead, hate living.
Pretty much.
I completely understand it. And in this one, too, what he's about to say. He says to Dr. Pretorius and the bride, "You stay, we belong dead."
Yep.
And right after he says dead, He pulls that lever, and boy, what an explosion.
Oh, yeah.
The whole time I'm going, okay, that's happening. That whole freaking building's demolished now. And while Henry and Elizabeth flee, the monster sheds a tear, and then he pulls the lever at this point. I forgot to mention that. He looks at the bride, and then he sheds a tear because he didn't want that.
No, he wanted to be happy.
Yeah.
And I feel that out of all the Universal movie monster movies, that was really stupid. All the movie monsters, that line.
We belong dead?
Yeah, the most iconic from... God, I cannot talk.
I think the we belong dead one is, and the hate living love dead one.
Yeah.
I think those two were my favorite.
You stay... We belong dead.
But yeah, the we belong dead line, very iconic. And you've heard it before in a lot of other movies too. It's just a phenomenal line. And that's the end of the movie. It ends right there. The destruction of the laboratory and tower. And that's when me and my girlfriend were like, oh, God damn it, that's it? I said, I'm just getting into this. There's got to be at least 20 minutes more, 15. Give us 10 at least. I mean... Oh, man, I really was enjoying it. I really was. Let's just get right into our final ratings here. Let's do it, because I got some things I want to say.
I kind of figured once you really sat down and watched this movie, I figured you'd really enjoy it.
It took me a little while. Once you get through the first 10 minutes, then you start to get really sucked into the story and everything. But do you want to do a final rating first, or you want me to go first?
I want you to go first.
Okay, so... With the exception of Elsa Lanchester, the acting's a little forced in the beginning scene, I have to say. And it kind of reminded me of what you said about The Invisible Man, about how, like, there's some, like, acting in there that's just super forced and above, like, over the top.
Hammy.
And, yeah, hammy. Little hokey. But, yeah, with the exception of Elsa, I just thought, wow, they're really overdoing it here. And I noticed a few things about the film compared to the first. This one is much faster pace. I mean, for some people, this could be good or it could be bad. For me, personally, it was just too fast. What I mean by that is Frankenstein. He's learned just from, I mean, this takes place right after he's burned. And the destruction of the mill from the first one. He's learned to walk better. He's talking now and learning. I'm analyzing this a little bit, but I can't help that, you know? I'm sure for its time, it was fine. And I know they want to just get straight to the point and just, you know, they're not telling like a whole week's story here or hours of, you know, they don't want to dig that deep. So they just cut to the chase basically. But for me, it was just a little too fast.
And I agree. I mean, this is a part where I think that a little bit of exposition would have gone a long way.
Yeah.
I understand why they did it because, I mean, these movies were not long epics like a lot of the movies we have today.
Right.
But if they would have fleshed out the story a little bit more, I think it would have helped with the flow a little bit.
The sets are really imaginative. We mentioned that before, just the forest set alone. The cinematography is just beautiful, and the costumes are extravagant, I thought. Especially the bride. The score in this film is more haunting and melancholic than the first one was, and it just fits it so well. There are some really effective scenes, but I found the scene between the monster and the blind hermit especially touching. James Whale's direction is innovative, just like in the first film, and the script is also great and adds to the atmosphere. All around, though, seriously, the acting... it's excellent. Elsa Lanchester is good as Mary Shelley, but, and I have to say this, electrifyingly beautiful.
Oi.
That's right, I did it. I said it.
Yeah, you did.
But really, I can't think of any other word that, I mean, she seriously was electrifyingly beautiful as the bride. She was great. Once again, though,
Gore. That was shocking.
God damn it, Mike, you did it again. Fuck. Okay, once again, though, Boris Karloff gives a fine performance. Probably his finest performance. His towering presence and frightening look definitely ensures for some scares in this one. That's one thing that I thought was separated from the first one. This one, I thought he was a little bit more monstrous and terrifying, if you were to compare. In the first one, he's new, he's scary and creepy and everything. I thought his appearance was creepier in the first one. But in this one, he's got more character.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just out there more and scary more. And I mean, the one part when Dr. Pretorius pretty much trains him to be a bad guy and tells him what he wants to accomplish. And at that point, you're thinking, come on, you know, the monster, like, now he's going to be bad, you know? But
right.
He doesn't know any better. But it was a little bit terrifying. So, with all that being said, once again, I give this rating a 10. Your turn.
Okay. I will give this one a 10 as well.
You sound so depressed. I guess I'll give it a 10.
Well, there were some things that I really, really enjoyed about this movie. I enjoyed the sets. The score was beautiful as always with these movies. I thought Elsa was absolutely amazing.
Electrifying.
Yes. Ha. And I... There were some things that I really did not like the way that
he talked.
The makeup. Oh, I hated that.
Yeah, that's one thing I forgot to point out. I didn't think it took away from the film. I mean, I understand why they did it,
mm-hmm.
but I also I understand more why Boris Karloff and James Whale did not want him to talk.
Right.
Boris Karloff thought it would take away from his character.
Yeah, and like I think
first,
it did.
Or in the first one. Well, I was watching the special features, and even Sarah Karloff said that it didn't take anything away, and it was fantastic. But
I
disagree a little bit, too.
It took away from that primal feeling that the monster had in the first one.
Yeah, he learned too quickly in this one.
Yeah.
That goes back
to... And again,
to
it goes back to the pacing of the movie.
Yeah, the pacing of the movie. Yes, thank you.
I mean, don't get me wrong. Boris Karloff could sit there and read the frickin' newspaper and I'd be entertained.
Always a
pleasure
to watch, no matter what he does.
I did not like the makeup near as much in this one as I did in the original.
Mm-hmm.
But notwithstanding, this movie is still, again, an iconic, very important movie. Just think off the top of your head how many horror movie monsters we have simply because of the monster. Jason, Leatherface, Michael Myers. Just that, from the first one and the second one, this, especially from the first one, that silent, never-ending force of nature type feel of the character.
Right.
Yeah, it's like, and I'm going off on another tangent, but...
That's okay.
It's like Jason. Mm-hmm. Jason I never have really considered to be good or evil. Jason is a force of nature, and that's kind of why when he comes around, the rain, the lightning, the thunder... Whatever, it's like he always shows up when the weather's bad, if that makes any sense.
I would say from, I gotta jump in here, Friday the 13th part 3 and up, I would agree with that. In the first one, and the second one especially, is a little different. I wouldn't say force of nature in the second one, he's more like a homeless hick.
I don't know.
Or a redneck with a burlap sack or something.
Rough Jason. But anyways, but yeah, so this is why this movie gets a 10, because again, it's a very important movie to the evolution of what we see today. So
you got to give this a lot of credit.
Oh yeah. Is this the best one that I've seen? Absolutely not. I mean, it's not The Mummy. It's not Dracula. It's not even the original Frankenstein.
It's not The Invisible Man.
We won't go there.
I said it. I said it.
Anyways, but yeah, so it definitely gets a 10 for me.
And that's good. That's good. I did not... You scared me before we started the podcast.
Oh, you thought I was going to give it like a 4, didn't
you?
No,
I thought you were going to give it like a 9.5 or 9.
Nah.
You must have really not have liked this if you gave it that. But no, you gave it a 10. That's, so 10's all around from us. It's that's really great.
It's definitely one that it's not the best in the series, but it's still
a lot
better than some of the stuff I've seen. So.
To be honest, I found this a little bit more enjoyable to watch than the first one. But I don't know if that's because I've seen the first one a bunch of times and I've never seen this one.
That could
very
well be, because you're watching it pretty much with, you know, fresh eyes.
Yes, and... I mean, it could be the story of mm-hmm. this one a little bit, you know, more. I just really wish that you saw more of the bride in this. She just wasn't in it enough.
I think that's probably my biggest issue, about, you know, beyond anything else with this movie.
No, it's not. Una O'Connor.
So like I said...
I'm going to have to find a clip of her screaming in that.
I will never come over here again.
You haven't listened to our last episode, have you?
Oh, boy.
If you haven't checked out our last episode of The Invisible Man, go do it now.
Yes, I'm lacking. I've been bad. I haven't listened to it yet.
It's okay. You were there.
Well, you expect me to remember that far back?
It was a week ago.
Have we met?
Again, here we go. All right, well... Okay, well, this was a really fun episode, though.
This one was good.
A little bit longer. So, with all of this being said and giving it a 10, do you have any final thoughts?
Just if you decide to watch this, if you haven't seen it before, I really hope you enjoy it.
So you would recommend it?
Oh, yes. There's not a movie in the entire catalog of Universal movies that I would not recommend.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, the older ones.
Yeah, I would definitely recommend it. I would just say go into this expecting a short ending.
Yeah, go into this movie knowing that the pacing is a little off. The ending is very abrupt.
Yes,
and there are some things that kind of bring it down a bit, but it's still a phenomenal movie and it's still worth a watch.
Yeah, definitely. As we've said before, you got to get in the right state of mind to watch movies from the 30s.
And you got to go in with an open mind.
Mm-hmm.
It's that simple. You got to go in knowing that there's some really hokey shit in this movie, but it's still a great movie.
Yeah, and you got to remember, for its time, you can't compare it to anything today.
No.
You really have to go in there and just clear your mind and remember this was a long time ago. And this is how they did things. And I think you could come to respect it more and understand it a little bit more, too, if you get through these movies. It's great. I'd recommend it as well. With that being said, I got some final thoughts. This was a stylish direction. It was a well-paced script, I thought, and a story that doesn't take itself too seriously. And it makes this classic pretty enjoyable now as it ever was when it was first released, I think. And I think James Whale directed his last horror movie with style and a grand sense of, I'm going to say it, graveyard humor. That elevates it. That's right, I said it. It elevates it high above most of the other Universal Monsters movies. And Karloff makes the monster a pitiable creature. One children and adults that I don't think will have any trouble empathizing with. Did I say that right?
Yes.
I cannot say it. I can't talk tonight. Again, I think the movie's most touching scene in this is... which the blind man befriends him. It's almost as funny as Mel Brooks' parody, like I've said, in Young Frankenstein. The stormy laboratory scene in which the bride creature comes to life is super thrilling. And just seeing the bride, she's riveting.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I can't use any other word than that, because when I first saw her come to life, I couldn't look away. It was so great. And then it ended, and I was pissed, because I wanted more. I think this movie really does leave you wanting more. So, yeah, like I said, even though she lives for only a few brief minutes on screen, her electrified hair, staring eyes, and mechanical jerks when she's looking around
like a
damn cockatiel. Yeah. won her an honored and well-deserved place in Hollywood's classic monster showcase. Clearly, I mean, because she's still remembered today. There's much more to enjoy here, though, than there is to be frightened of. Overall, seriously, this is a wonderful sequel, and it's highly recommended if you've never watched it. And I'm going to just leave it at that. Thank you all for listening. We have only 3 more Universal Monsters installments left.
Yep.
It's hard to believe.
Get good.
Oh, yeah. I'm very excited for these next 3. But our next one we're doing for our installment, we'll be discussing The Wolfman.
Nice.
With Lon Chaney Jr. And I can't wait. I've probably seen this film more than any of the other Universal Monsters, so I'm more familiar with it.
This one's going to be really good. This and The Phantom.
And The Creature.
And The Creature.
Those are the last 3 we're doing.
And I'm super excited about...
Super-y.
Anyway.
Super-y.
I'm very excited about doing these 3, especially The Phantom, because Johnny has never seen that. And that's going to be fun.
Yeah, I'm very much looking forward to that. This completes our 21st episode of the Chainsaw Enema Show.
Yeah.
Remember, you could listen to our previous episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcast, and wherever else you could find podcasts, pretty much. And if you have any suggestions or requests, you can go to our Facebook page and send us a message, email us, whatever. And remember, please rate us and leave a review on Apple Podcast. Don't forget to lock your doors and windows. Check the closet and look under the bed. Until the next time, I'm Johnny B. Ghoul.
And I'm Misfit Mike.
Always remember to keep the horror alive.